Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, an anchor of stability in a destabilized world, at least most of the time. Two guests, two segments today. We'll hear from Jody Dean on why the left should not be anti-woke, and then from Emily Jashinsky on fissures and previously solid right-wing support for Israel. Some people on the left have reacted to the second round of Trump by saying that maybe he's right about wokeness, that it had gone too far, it had alienated the ever-elusive and fundamentally undefinable normies. Instead of celebrating marginalized identities, we should focus instead on an economic agenda that unifies the working class. I've spent decades on economic issues, and I'm all for focusing on them, but not to the exclusion of the so-called cultural issues. Okay, there is some silly language policing and the like, but overall, this line strikes me as a failure of solidarity and a betrayal of some of the weakest, most marginalized members of this violent hierarchical society. Frequent Behind the News guest Jody Dean has an excellent piece called Beyond the Classism of Defeat that first appeared several months ago in Spanish in the Latin American edition of Jacobin. It's now out in English on a site called Communists. She sees the surrender to anti-wokeism as a sign of weakness, a failure of imagination driven by a deep misunderstanding of who and what the working class is today. Jody is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. Jody Dean. You open your article with the moment when Javier Milei, the maniacally libertarian president of Argentina, bestowed a chainsaw on Elon at the CPEC conference earlier this year. Musk made vroom vroom sounds you might expect of the man-child that he is. But what is it about these guys and their infantile spectacles?
It's a kind of shamelessness and willingness to perform their own outrageousness that... it's not just driving sort of media hits, which it is, right? It's like really performative, like we're so out there, we can get away with anything. But I think it's the way that this crazy antics is like owning the libs or poo-pooing regular political society to say, you guys don't control the terms, you don't control the narrative. We've got the power, we've got the strength, and we're going to just perform the wild boy antics that we can. It's pretty ridiculous. If we just step back, I mean, and maybe now it's been a few months since those crazy chainsaw events occurred, and now Elon is out of favor. With a little bit of hindsight, we can see it for the stupid, stupid annex that it is. But there was, I think, a kind of sense. It's like, oh, wow, they're so fearless. They can get away with anything. And honestly, this may be off topic for today's conversation, but it's made me think about all of this Trump-Epstein stuff and wondering if part of the attraction on some on the right to Trump is the sense that he can get away with anything in kind of this way that Musk and Milei were as well.
Trump, of course, famously said years ago that he could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and get away with it. And, you know, he turned out to be pretty much right about that.
Yeah, and I think that we shouldn't underestimate the role of this kind of shamelessness on the part of the billionaire class, the far right, Trump, you know, Bolsonaro, and so on, that it's a way that they perform their power. And it makes some people feel like, oh, wow, you know, they really can get away with anything. And it makes other people really quite afraid.
I need to go back and read this. It's been a while, but recall that Horkheimer had a bit about how the fascist leader is, there's something comic about them. Hitler, you know, in his silly dances, Mussolini was a comic figure in a lot of ways. Trump, Musk, Milei, they're all, there's something absurd about them that, see, somehow connected to this idea of fascist power. Do you understand this?
Do I understand it? I don't know if I understand it. I think that I recognize it. Like, there's a little Trump dance that appears online all the time where he's moving his arms in a kind of weird, awkward way.
Oh, yeah, he was doing that in the White House roof the other day.
Oh, my God. That's like, so this is part of this general shamelessness. And the part that I think is significant in it, and is this an understanding? I don't know. But is that it flouts norms and it says, I'm above it. It doesn't apply to me. Your regular laws, your regular expectations, the conventions of, let's say, constitutional, liberal, bourgeois society don't apply to me. And it's that kind of flouting of convention that I think attracts some who feel like the world is in a terrible place and our conventions are hurting us. And again, like I said a second ago, makes others of us quite nervous and concerned about the effects on our society.
Well, as you say in the article, they're performing a radicality that they present as bringing down the establishment, but in fact, it's emboldening cops and enriches billionaires. I mean, that's really quite a formula they've got going.
Yeah, it's so strange how it's the case that the left does not seem to represent radical opposition anymore. Well, one might say that, well, that's false. Actually, anarchists in the street represent radical opposition. And that's why the right is always, you know, particularly the Trump right, you know, lamenting and scared about and trashing Antifa. Or one could say, well, it's the case that the left represents opposition when we see these struggles against ICE. That's a form of left opposition. And so maybe there's a partial truth on that, but it still seems to me that popularly, broadly speaking, and not just in the US, but you know, in Argentina and Brazil and big hunks of Europe, that it's the right that has somehow put itself in the position of being able to provide the language of opposition, the language of popular grievance, even as it's doing that to protect the, you know, asset-holding capitalist billionaire class.
There's a way in which the left, at least in mainstream discourse, has gotten identified with a liberal professional managerial class. And those people are, you know, like, I recall this essay after Hillary Clinton lost that said, she reminds everyone of the human resources office. You know, that there's some finger wagging, you're misbehaving, that's inappropriate. That's not historically what I think of as the left, but I guess that whole professional managerial human resources sensibility has spread to us, and we're having to suffer from it.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, that's clearly true. It is a fact that we experience in our everyday lives, particularly folks who may work in academia or in public services. But we also just see it in social media all the time. But I wonder if somehow we jump too quickly into the right-wing characterization of the school marm, human resources person, and don't pay sufficient attention to the ways that, in fact, what we understand as the working class has actually changed, right? The majority of people in the working class in the United States are in services. Some of these services are things like human resources and payroll management. And these services, the left has typically used a language of the petty bourgeoisie or PMC class, and it can often be annoying. But what if this is actually more what the class looks like, and that we, instead of trashing them for doing things that we don't like, we recognize their economic position and recognize that throughout the bureaucracies, there are a whole bunch of people with all sorts of different backgrounds who are employed, and that some of the resentment and treating this as if it were just Karens, white women, Hillary Clinton, and so on, fussing at us, we start to see, no, there's something in our resentment that's actually reflecting perhaps our own inability to recognize changes in the class. That's what I wanted to try to think about.
Yeah, I'd like to return to this. Let's talk a bit about wokeism, which is a related topic. And it's just really amazing how the right just can't give up on wokeism. They can't stop talking about it. But, you know, you have people on some variety of the left that also can't stop talking about wokeism as the source of all our problems. Now, certainly today's reactionary agenda has a large economic component, boosting profits, slashing regulations, smashing whatever remnants of working class power survived 40 years of neoliberalism. But the so-called cultural issues, you know, nativism, racism, sexuality, abortion, are also a big part of the right-wing agenda. And there are some on the left who view these cultural issues as a distraction from the real issues, the basic bread and butter stuff. Now, I'm all for the basic bread and butter stuff,
yeah.
But the cultural issues are not a distraction. Why are they so central to the right's agenda?
It seems to me that the right, and again, not just in the U.S., but internationally, is following a kind of Yoram Hazony national conservative playbook. And they're trying to protect a specific version of national purity, of the family, and order, right? A particular kind of order. We've seen a lot of the Catholic conservatives pushing this kind of order, what's natural, it means two sexes, and this whole attack on gender ideology, immigration, national and racialized minorities. So I think the national conservative playbook, actually, in its attempt to protect the capitalist and asset-holding economic formation, is pursuing a set of cultural politics, right? They're trying to redirect attention away from the real legitimate economic grievances and problems and formulate those in cultural terms. So we can't avoid this because that's what they're doing, right? That's where the fight is. And what the left shouldn't do is echo and reinforce the right-wing talking point. That, to me, is like where the huge mistake comes in. It should be much more, the analysis has to be recognizing that the right's doing it rather than reinforcing their views.
Look back at, I feel like I'm already violating Godwin's law, but here we are talking, I'm going to start talking about Hitler for a moment. but, one of the early acts of the Nazis was the Decadent Art Show attacking that sexuality think tank. This stuff is actually very important to them. Something about sanctity of gender and nation. And you could say it's a distraction or a diversion or a way to whip up the masses on things that are secondary. But I don't know, it does seem something that really motivates them at a deep psychological level.
I think you're right to point to these parallels. And it seems like the kind of larger container for this is this preoccupation with order that begins with a fundamental sense of sexual order, and that anything that calls us into questions, that threatens this, that points out, hey, the world is actually a lot messier than this, that's threatening. What I think that the other question is, though, is that how much is this kind of affective politics, for lack of a better term right now, how much of this is actually mobilizing to majorities, and how much of it is good cultural clickbait and mobilizing to a very online media class who finds this a lot more fun and interesting to talk about than the fact of people not being able to pay their bills or find housing or keep their kids in line for decent health and a decent education. We don't have to fall into the sense that the right is onto something when they're pursuing this.
Is there anything to be gained by embracing this anti-woke agenda? People on the left often say it's a reasonable compromise, a way to win friends among the masses, which presumes the masses are bigots and irredeemably so. Is it a reasonable compromise?
No. Who are the masses? Who are the masses? There's this bizarre, unstated view of the masses of Americans as white working class men. Who else does the anti-woke agenda appeal to? It's a way of constructing a fantasy view of who the working class is. That's not what the working class looks like in the United States. The U.S. working class has multiple races, multiple genders, multiple ages, multiple orientations, right? To pursue an anti-woke version assumes from the beginning that that diverse class does not exist. It's politically wrong. It's also empirically wrong.
I'm speaking with the political scientist, Jody Dean. Well, as Corey Robin argues that some of the emotional energy for right-wing politics comes from the sense that the patriarch has lost authority in his castle. Do we want to talk to that patriarch?
Here's the thing. Is it really the case that this is what is mobilizing or can mobilize not the patriarch, but white working class men? That's who this seems that the whole anti-woke politics seems to be presuming that they're talking to. It strikes me as most effective for left organizers to talk to people where they are and learn from what their concerns are and try to give them an explanation for what their change in life circumstances are that explains the 40 years of neoliberalism, the unleashing of a billionaire class, the fact that now we're going to have trillionaires, and that their economic position is not because of women. It's not because of some change in patriarchy. It's because of the way that neoliberal capitalism has unfolded, and now that the forms of accumulation are diminishing. There's an economic problem. I think we shouldn't take for granted where people are and assume that because the right is trying to reach people as potential little kings and lords and patriarchs, that that's the way to organize. Absolutely not. We have to provide a better explanation of what their circumstances are. So it's part of, I think, a better left narrative, a better left language of grievance, rather than falling into, oh, what we compromise with the far right by accepting their narrative of grievance? Absolutely not.
I was thinking that observation of George Bush's advisor, Matthew Dowd, who said that if you argue against us while using our language, we're winning.
Absolutely. 100%. 100%.
Now, there's also a view of the working class that's, I think, excessively narrow. For example, sometimes it's defined as people without a college degree. 40% of the adult population in the U.S. now has a bachelor's or more. 40 years ago, there were more people who hadn't finished high school and had a college degree, and now that's completely changed. So there's this really antique and also constricted view of just who the working class is.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, Doug. It's interesting how with... I'll date it to the defeat of the Soviet Union and the way that that had a huge impact on the left everywhere. Since then, it's been very hard for leftists and socialists to basically to fight and to organize. And so we have relied on old narratives and not produced a strong analysis of class and class formation and class change and how it's changed with the changing of the population. And we tend to then, again, this is part of, I think, the context of defeat, we tend to slide into the same assumptions that liberals make, where demography is destiny, the correct way to think about classes in terms of education, the working class is primarily industrial, and none of those work. So what's really called for is not falling into the liberal mindset, but going back to being good old historical materialists that are realizing the empirical realities of how class is experienced in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental thing about being working class is that if you don't work, you're on the sidewalk. Your status within the working class is measured by how many weeks it would take you to end up on the sidewalk, but that's the fundamental thing that makes class in capitalist society.
Yeah, and it's interesting now the way, in fact, people can work incredible hours and still end up on the sidewalk because of the absolute rise in housing cost and food cost, and which is one of the reasons that Mamdani did so well in the Democratic primary in New York, was appealing to these kinds of bread and butter issues.
It's just amazing to watch the bourgeois reaction to Mamdani because, you know, he's got a pretty mild social democratic agenda. And there, Laura Ingraham had on somebody recently she described as a survivor of Mao's revolution to comment on Mamdani's agenda. These people are absolutely delusional in their fears. Like, I always wonder what's behind this. Is it a bad conscience, a fear their throats are going to get slit as they sleep? I mean, it's just a bizarre overreaction to what is a fairly mild agenda.
Yeah, it really lets us see how fragile actually they recognize their position to be. Then this makes me think, rather than anyone on the left kind of compromising with the right and adapting their analyses or sharing some of their narratives, in fact, we do better to see how fragile they are. We do better to exploit the cracks in their agenda and their weakness.
Now, you call this left susceptibility to anti-wokeism, the classism of defeat. What do you mean by that?
One of the things that strikes me in the last 6-8 months iteration of the class / identity dispute is that the people who are taking an anti-woke line tend to want to reject wokeism as identity politics and identity reductionism. And what's so strange to me is that, in fact, because the anti-woke view is in fact invested in a particular view of the working class as white male heads of families, and they don't always state this, it just seems like it's the underlying supposition, they're the ones who are identity reductionists. They're the ones who are invested in a view that says, like, oh no, these poor former patriarchs are really hurt and injured. It's almost like they're going into the sort of weakest, most harmed poor guys. That's the kind of argument that they criticize when they see feminist making it or anti-racist making it. So it seems like it's a view that's coming from this defeated working class position rather than a let's build class power position. Their defeated version actually has the effect of then continuing the fragmenting of the working class by not seeing it in all its diversity, by not seeing it as unfolding across a whole array of forms of employment that are not the standard old industrial working class employment. So it's like they presuppose a kind of defeat on several levels. Building strength requires recognizing the diversity of the working class rather than trying to hold on to a kind of fantasy of the old white male industrial worker, which hasn't been the case in like 40 years.
You say in the piece, the majority of workers today are not producers, whose combined and centralized forces are emblematic of progress, development, and modernity. Most workers are in services. Like servants, their jobs are meeting others' needs or catering to their desires. Now, that does seem like you're a bit nostalgic for the old horny-handed sons of toil model. But is there a way that we can think of a service-based working class as somehow that engine of history, the motor of progress, to use a couple of industrially-based metaphors?
Yeah, I think we can use the services as a new vanguard imaginary, particularly when we recognize the fact that we're on a warming planet and that climate change is one of the, if not the major unfolding catastrophes that we encounter. We cannot go back, as much as the Trump administration is trying to make us go into an industrial fossil-fueled kind of economy and pushing, you know, going backwards on all the environmental measures. And
he wants to ban windmills now. The obsession with windmills
is insane.
Just so bizarre.
It's so bizarre. So we need to think of services, particularly things like health and education, but not only. We need to think of services as a vanguard so that we can recognize that it's not simply producing steel that is a source of class power. Well, I mean, and everybody recognizes steel workers as powerful, or even auto workers as powerful, but let's recognize and sort of hail, interpolate in good old Althusserian terms, service workers as a kind of vanguard for an economy on a warming planet. And I think education and health are a huge site for that kind of organizing and of interpolation. But in general, for the left, to recognize that the class is diverse and that much of the work is in services can go far in providing an imaginary that's not susceptible to the classism of defeat, and it does not repeat the attack on wokeness.
We could think of services as a way of socializing care labor, which is, you know, historically been within the household and performed by unacknowledged and very exploited women. So this that is a positive model for thinking of the service sector.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I talked in your show about this book that Charisse Burden-Stelly and I edited, Organize, Fight, Win. It collects the writings of Black communist women from the first half of the 20th century. And what's so interesting about their work is how early on, as communist and communist adjacent organizers, they were really attuned to domestic labor, to the role of women in their communities and in the labor force as domestic workers. And so there's already been a history on the left, you know, on the communist left, of trying to organize care labor, paid and unpaid.
You asked the question, which I think is a very good one. Why is decency towards another person such a burden? I mean, the pronoun issue, for example, it's complicated. There's a whole lot of stuff that meets around pronouns. But on one level, it's just respecting people's desire to be addressed the way they think of themselves. It's an act of courtesy, just human decency, aside from all the gender revolutionary side of it. But it does seem to be such a burden to a lot of people. Like, they roll their eyes, they're so annoyed. It's something that motivates them to embrace a really brutalized politics.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about this, and I think we've talked about this kind of thing over the years. I'll confess it, you know, I had to learn, and I learned a lot from my comrades to get a better position on this, and really did come down just exactly where you are. It's just like, it's just decent to call people what they want to be called. It's no skin off anybody else's back, right? It shouldn't bother you at all. If somebody wants, they tell you their name, they tell you their pronouns, and that's what you call them, right? Like, that's not hard. But I think people feel nervous by changes in society. They feel nervous about a world out of control. They feel nervous and apprehensive and anxious around climate change and an economy that does not suggest that they will be able to live as well as their parents did, and they're afraid for their lives. And so I think that little things become bigger and bigger. And for some, it's like, okay, this is just the last straw. You're asking me to do too much. You're asking me to change too much. On the left, as organizers, we have to be understanding of this and then just remind people, you know, it's just decent to call someone by their name. And I think a lot of people will, when you frame it that way, will come around. And so again, there's no need to be anti-woke. It can just be, okay, we'll be courteous, everybody. And everybody will be like, okay.
Yeah, yes. Okay. And then to conclude, I think one of your final sentences, is, if not the final one in the piece, is those who neglect struggles around immigration, gender, and race fail to recognize how our potential and our strength comes from combinations of the many. I mean, that's a really marvelous sentiment. So just to conclude, could you expand upon that a bit?
We have to think about how do we build power. That's the bottom line. And we have to build power among the working class that we have. And this is a working class that's extremely spread out, diverse, with all sorts of different kinds of strengths and experiences. That's how we become powerful. We build from the many, where the many are, and use their diversity as one of our weapons.
That was Jody Dean, professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and author of Beyond the Classism of Defeat, which is on a website called Communists. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the second movement of Gustav Mahler's Fourth Symphony, performed by the Cleveland Orchestra under Pierre Boulez. Next, fissures are opening up in previously solid Republican support for Israel. The most striking evidence of this are recent comments by the inimitable Marjorie Taylor Greene, the first prominent member of her party to use the word genocide to describe what's been happening in Gaza. Yes, MTG is a curious case, but this looks like an important development. Greene told the Daily Mail the other day that she's about had it with her party. I don't know if the Republican Party is leaving me, or I'm kind of not relating to the Republican Party as much anymore. I don't know which one it is, she said. She still loves Trump and is still quite right-wing, but she sees the party as having turned its back on regular Americans and gone back to being a party of neocons and good old boys. Here to report on that and related happenings in the party is our native informant on the right, Emily Jashinsky. Emily is the D.C. correspondent for Unheard, co-host of Breaking Points, and host of a new podcast, After Party. Emily mentions dispensationalism, a school of evangelical Christianity that is an important part of the religious right. Among other things, dispensationalists believe that the establishment of Israel was part of God's plan for humanity, a sign that the end times are near. Emily Jashinsky. Marjorie Taylor Greene, always a lively character, used the word genocide to describe what's going on in Gaza, what Israel has been doing to Gaza. That's a big deal on the right. It would be a big deal among mainstream Dems, too, but that's another story. Now, how widespread is that point of view? Is she reflecting something?
Steve Bannon also said, just as Marjorie Taylor Greene was making this point, that under 30, basically nobody in under 30 MAGA supports Israel anymore. That was a comment he gave to Politico. So I don't think it's mainstream. If you look at the polling, there's still a lot of support for Israel. I mean, a shocking gulf between Republicans and then independents and Democrats when it comes to support for Israel. Republicans remain very supportive of Israel. But when you get to the next generation, millennials, Gen Z, of people who are coming into positions of power and to becoming bigger portions of the electorate, it's a totally different ballgame. And you know, I can't actually really think of many issues where we've seen such a stark generation gap.
That's true across the spectrum, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You see the same thing on the left.
Two related questions occur to me. One is, how do you explain that intense attachment among older Republicans and the official Republican stance? And then how do you explain this break? What happened with the younger people?
I've seen some interesting theories. So I'm a millennial, so I don't have a lot of political memories before like the late 90s. And even that's a little bit of a stretch. But I've seen some interesting theories that it has to do with people who grew up in the Oslo era and have memories of Israel from Clinton's first term. You know, we didn't really see this divide even during the Reagan era. It wasn't quite the same as it turned into the next couple of decades. There was also the movement among evangelicals to try and make dispensationalism from the Left Behind books and movies, to try and make dispensationalism a bigger and bigger part of what it meant to be a post 9/11 Christian conservative or slightly pre 9/11 Christian conservative. And so there was that really stark cultural attachment, especially for evangelical Christians who vote Republican overwhelmingly. So that's my best guess. I think with younger people, one thing I want to say is we see a lot of the same dynamics at play in the post-October 7th war in Gaza, but we're seeing right now something that we haven't seen in a very long time. I mean, the level of death and destruction with no clear end in sight when you are Gen Z or you're millennials and you come of age during the global war on terror post 9/11 and you have seen the deaths of so many civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan with not much to show for both of those wars. Basically, everybody now feels like those wars were a mistake. And you look at what's happened in Gaza, especially also, by the way, is nobody can afford houses. It becomes a completely different set of issues than it was, say, 2005.
Yeah, now let's ship Israel $17 billion so they can kill more people, but I can't afford anything. Yeah, I just saw a poll today that 54% of Americans report severe stress on grocery prices, and 14% are using buy now, pay later to buy groceries. So there's really a lot of distress out there. So obviously Christian Zionism, as you said, is an important part of the Republican base. Appointing Mike Huckabee as ambassador to Israel, it really underscored this. So is there a fissure developing, and how are the party leaders, the party establishment, reacting to this apparent heresy?
Party leaders are doubling and tripling down. I mean, Speaker Mike Johnson is in Israel right now. It's August recess. They just passed their one big, beautiful bill, and they, you know, said it was so important to go home for August recess to be selling the bill to the public. Well, he went to Israel. That's where he is right now. And again, doubling, tripling down. Donald Trump has doubled and tripled down on his bear hug of Netanyahu, even though, apart from other Republicans, he is more willing to say that, you know, he said there was a real starvation problem in Gaza when a lot of Republicans were still saying that that was propaganda. So he's, you know, as usual, a little bit different, but we're not really seeing much of that from any other Republicans in leadership. It's pretty much just been doubling and tripling down, not just on Israel, but also doubling and tripling down on accusing Israel's critics of being anti-American and in some ways anti-Semitic.
Yeah, they've been using that anti-Semitism as a club, you know, from universities to everywhere. Marjorie Taylor Greene and Steve Bannon will complicate that mission a bit, won't they?
Yeah, it does. And that's another thing is interesting about maybe explaining this fissure generationally, that for a lot of younger conservatives, they fought, like their political awakening was fighting the overly broad definitions of things like racism and bigotry and sexism that were applied to them as they saw it during the 2015, basically the last 10 years, that sort of campus culture, that arena, a lot of those conservatives were fighting that. And they're very sensitive to that question of overly broad definitions. And I think the way that we've seen anti-Semitism since October 7th be used so nakedly as a weapon, the House of Representatives passing a toothless resolution, but one that said that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, that I think has also been awakening or has nudged younger conservatives to kind of look around and say, what the heck is going on? This isn't right.
Yeah, well, that intense emphasis on anti-Semitism seemed to me like a reaction to elites feeling like they're losing control of this issue, that they're experiencing dissent in Israel is just unprecedented in modern American politics. So if this spreads to the Republican Party, that will only increase the hysteria of the usage.
Yeah, I think it's totally changed the incentive structure. And part of this is because there's new media. So I was thinking actually hypothetically in my head what a Marjorie Taylor Greene in 2014 would have done in this situation where you don't have, you know, as she sees it, Bannon's War Room, Newsmax, you don't have the video capabilities that Twitter has now to kind of go directly to people. The podcast boom hasn't quite happened. Does she use the word genocide in 2014, or does that cut off completely her access to being able to go on Hannity or being able to go on Fox News, being able to go on talk radio? I think it does. And I don't think she does it in 2014 for that reason, because the cost-benefit analysis for her, it would have been a total blackout and totally cut her off. There wouldn't have been other places for her to go. And so I think partially the gatekeepers losing their power has changed this issue for younger conservatives too.
I find her a fascinating figure. Obviously, her politics are very different from mine. But does she just say what comes into her head? Is there any like method behind what she's doing? Does she have some kind of coherent point of view? Explain Marjorie Taylor Greene to the curious leftist.
Well, I think we've seen her, even just in the last week, say that MAGA is being taken over by people who don't support the working class, the average American. And this is an interesting through line for Marjorie Taylor Greene, where she really doesn't have a sort of scholarly approach to ideology. She's someone who I think after the Tea Party movement was electrified by the populist rhetoric of Donald Trump. And to the extent that she has an ideology, it's sort of the worldview is not this like cohesive DC think tank ideology. It's more just whatever she thinks is animating, you know, the average American and at any given point. And that is interesting. I actually think of her in a similar vein to some, and this is going to be very offensive to a lot of people on the left, but I mean it in a very sort of fundamental sense, to some people in the squad. Actually, I think of her similarly to Jamal Bowman. And one of the reasons I do is that they both sort of started as 9/11 conspiracy theorists, and both ended up in Congress and had evolved and refined worldviews that went beyond just that. I think both of them have since repudiated their views on that. But it was this idea that we're being lied to, that we're being screwed over, that we are being impoverished for the sake of these foreign conflicts.
Well, when you put it that generally, you know, a lot of people would agree with that.
Yeah. And there's something that Washington is very gross. There's something that Washington has always turned its nose up about. This is the House of Representatives. It's supposed to be representative of the population. And, you know, a lot of the population does have really dark theories about why some of these things have happened, because they are lied to about literally everything else. So I think she's kind of in that vein. She wants to represent the average American, but she doesn't always have like this cohesive, scholarly, ideological idea of what that looks like. So it means she sometimes sides with the right, sometimes she sides with the left, but she also has kind of changed along the way.
Marjorie Taylor Greene is famous for some remarks years ago about space lasers, which I don't think she actually used the phrase Jewish space lasers, but that's what it got remembered as, Jewish space lasers. Is there any anti-Semitism underlying this attitude? And also more generally, you know, anti-Semitism has been a problem on the far right for a long time. Is that just bubbling under the surface? Well, how does that fit in?
I actually am constantly wondering how significant this proportion of the broader right that is anti-Semitic. I'm genuinely curious if we see more of it on social media because Elon took over X. I mean, actually, particularly just on X, definitely not on Instagram or anywhere like that. But if we see more of it because Elon has changed the algorithm, or if it's actually growing, or maybe both. My suspicion is that it's both. I don't think somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene at all, and I'm saying this as an evangelical Christian, is anti-Semitic because those just groups of Christians are so, even if they're not dispensationalist, so if their end times eschatology doesn't involve the political state of Israel, even if they're not in that category, they're deeply, deeply sympathetic to Israel and the cause of Israel. And that's not in any way anti-Semitic, but on the other side, I do think, you know, if you look at Nick Fuentes, for example, who seems to keep having a bigger audience, that's legitimate anti-Semitism. And, you know, I don't think it represents any like average American voter or average Republican voter, but I do think there's some of the anti-Israel stuff is anti-Semitic. I just don't know how big that group is.
You could be an anti-Semite and be happy with the Jews in Israel, just as long as they're not next door.
Yeah, definitely. I guess that's true. I think there's also the Israel stuff for the right is just so deeply, it's such a reflex that I think one of the reasons Fuentes has maybe a bigger and bigger audience is that everyone is now questioning everything that happened post-Trump, it happened post-COVID. And so when sometimes people start questioning things, you know, like you've been told you're conservative Christian Republican, you support Israel your whole life, and then you look at what's happened in Gaza, that can lead you to a really good direction, or it could lead you to a really bad direction. And I think there's probably some of the latter happening too.
Speaking with the journalist Emily Jashinsky. Let's talk more broadly about the political situation right now. I was just watching a clip of Mike Flood's town hall in Nebraska, and he was defending his vote for the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and he was getting booed and shouted down. Are the Republicans who are going home to try to sell this bill going to find a hostile audience, and are they going to stop shooting the town halls?
Yeah, you know, I'm curious about that because they really thought they needed to get out there in August and be going as crazy as they could back in their districts selling this bill. And I talked to some House Republicans right before the recess. And one of the questions I asked is, well, Donald Trump is underwater on the economy. He's underwater on immigration, underwater on foreign policy, but particularly on the economy.
Now, immigration, that used to be his strong point too, right?
Yeah, it's there's an interesting MAGA bubble where Republicans who used to be sort of constantly hounded by criticism because they paid attention to the mainstream media, they're now in MAGA media world and don't necessarily pick up on the mood of the public in such a way. I think, you know, people would generally, if you talk to a lot of Republicans around here, people would tell you that's a fake poll, it's not real. But on the economy, they said one of the reasons they passed that bill when they did is so that some of the economic incentives that they see in it could kick in before the midterm elections, which is just a hell of a gamble. So I don't think they quite know what they're in for. They expect to go home and say, listen, we have all of these manufacturing exemptions, building exemptions, like that's bringing jobs back. You know, none of the disastrous predictions about the trade war came to pass. But a lot of people are going to say, well, that's a very low bar. And the uncertainty is not good. We've seen some price increases. And I just don't think they realize how much this has animated the kind of grassroots activist left that's going to organize and bombard a lot of these town halls and create pretty disastrous optics.
I do most of the food shopping in our household, and I remember being just stunned during the Biden inflation by how expensive everything had gotten. And I'm getting that feeling again, and I can't be alone in this. And for, you know, then the establishment Democrats, all the liberal economists are saying, oh, it's just all in your head. And now if you're going to see the Republicans do the same thing, deny that these cost of living pressures are real, that could be a serious political mistake, as the Biden people learned.
I was thinking about this yesterday. Yes, because it's just so discordant where you, for partisan purposes, have to trumpet the economy. Kamala Harris struggled with this enormously in the stage of her campaign because she had to run on the Biden economy, but she was also trying to be a little bit different, which was very interesting. And Republicans now are walking around saying Donald Trump is the greatest president ever, which, you know, of course, implicitly means that you have the greatest economy ever. And he passed his big, beautiful bill and the trade war is a success, which means you're telling people that they should be happy and they should be feeling this transformation of the American economy, and they aren't yet.
Yeah, and then you can fire the director of the BLS, but people are still going to feel it when they check out.
Right? It doesn't change anything at all. And Trump was on CNBC earlier today talking about how the foreign-born percentage of the workforce has gone down. And so even with that BLS report, they're picking certain things out of it to say this is a good economy. But if it's not actually a good economy, that can be devastating.
Now, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act sailed through Congress. Very few of the legislative niceties like hearings and expert testimony and debate. It seems like you'd have to go back to FDR for a precedent for a president who so dominated Congress and was able to get legislation passed easily. But you know, FDR won in repeated landslides and was immensely popular. Trump won a narrow victory and his polling looks bad. And you might think a low approval rating would weaken congressional support, but it really hasn't. So how do you explain his hold over Congress and the party more broadly?
The right has arrived at a litmus test that is, they think, the best way to suss out loyalty, because disloyalty on the right has proven disastrous. It has led to like the January 6th committee, as they see it, and the chaos of the first Trump White House and all of that. So one of the reasons you just don't see anyone on Capitol Hill going against Donald Trump, and if they do, it's in a very strategic way with very particular language that they've learned it's been finely tuned over the course of the last decade. But the reason that you see that is because nobody wants to fail that central litmus test that has been aggressively applied and embraced by the White House and by Trump's advisors. So he basically is able to do what he wants. I mean, even with the tariffs, yes, there are a lot of Republicans who are elected after 2016 in Congress right now, but the reason he didn't go through Congress for those tariffs, that you couldn't get them through Congress, like never in a million years. And yet they all say that they support the tariffs. So it just, that is the litmus test. That is the loyalty test, is how he maintains so much control over the party.
Are they all afraid of a Truth Social post? What is the root of his power?
They're totally afraid of a Truth Social post. We saw this with Senator Hawley just last week, who Trump posted about on Truth Social. And this could have been so devastating to Hawley. This was over his plan to ban members from trading stocks. And Trump posted about it on Truth Social because clearly some other Republican, we now know this from reporting, another Republican senator who probably wants to keep trading stocks, called Trump up and said that Hawley was acting in a way that was helpful to Nancy Pelosi. And Trump immediately posted about it aggressively on Truth Social, called Hawley a second-tier senator. And this was, it was such a devastating blow to Hawley that he scrambled and desperately was able to get Trump's ear. And that Truth Social is still up and it's a permanent scar. But Hawley says that Trump kind of backed down on it. We'll see where that goes. But these posts have a lot of power on the right.
It's funny, though, because, you know, you look at his numbers. It's a fraction of what he had on Twitter, the followers, the likes, the retweets and all that. The Truth Social is really a bubble.
Totally.
Social media generally is quite a bubble, but, you know, that is really a bubble. But still, he has that immense power just by typing a few words in all caps with a few misspellings, and the world trembles before him.
But he's very polite. He always thanks people for their attention to any
kind of
matter.
What is that all about? Thank you for it.
It's such a wild quirk.
I know. I can, like, threaten war with Russia and say thank you for your attention to this matter. It's just, it's wild. Well, speaking of the Russia turn, it's, you know, it's really hard to read what's going on there. You know, there's all these accusations that he was a KGB agent, and, you know, his election is a result of Russian manipulation. And he was secretly controlled by Putin, and now he's, like, threatening him. Does he feel betrayed by his former love interest? How do you explain what this turn on Russia?
If we take the romance out of it, at least, I think there is some element where Donald Trump was all over the campaign trail, confidently talking about how he could end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. And I have to say, I follow this obviously closely. It's my job. And I thought that was not insane because the Biden administration was being so belligerent. The ATACMS authorization, it was frustrating to watch the Biden administration deal with Zelensky and deal with Ukraine. And Trump seemed to have a decent relationship with Putin and Ukraine. Did I think it was going to happen? No. But did I think it was insane? Also, that Trump could do that because he, unlike any other leader, we've seen a lot of leaders say nice things about Putin, American leaders say nice things about Putin right after they met him. And then what did Bush say, that he could see his soul?
Oh, he saw his soul, right? Yeah. Pooty-poot. He called him Pooty-poot.
I think Trump really believed that he and Putin had an understanding of best interests and this mutual respect. And yeah, that was as naive probably as Bush saying that he could see Putin's soul in his eyes. But when it's a stalemate like this, I think he really overestimated his ability to get everybody to the table. It's not vindicating for the Biden people, but it is, I think, a sign that Trump and Putin didn't have the relationship that Trump thought they did.
And then finally, what is the Epstein business going to do to the Republican Party? Is it, that seems like a real point of vulnerability for Trump, threatening this iron control he's had over the party in Congress. Does this thing have legs?
Oh, yeah. I saw someone yesterday talking about how the pundit class, the podcast class, has been wrong about how the Trump base would react to them completely bungling their promise of transparency in the Epstein files and that MAGA stayed with him, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's half true. Mostly MAGA stayed with him, but also MAGA is staying with him because the DOJ is still saying they're going to get answers. They're like, any day now, maybe we'll release this transcript of the Maxwell interview in court. We're going to get to the bottom of this. The left is, you know, this is a Bill Clinton problem. You hang on. We're still working on it. Don't worry. So I think, you know, if you get to the end of 4 years with nothing, that's a problem. It's a problem for people who were involved in it, like Pam Bondi, who maybe want a political future. But also, I think probably the most important political consequence is the group that's been dubbed the Barstool Conservative, Barstool MAGA. People like Dave Portnoy of Barstool Sports, who are kind of social libertines, but anti what they would say is woke and want low taxes and all of that. The podcast world covered the Epstein story for reasons that we all understand, covered it so closely. It became the most high-profile example of elite decadence and corruption. And a lot of independents, this was kind of baked into the cake, JFK files, Epstein files, of why they ascribed a different level of trust and transparency to what they expected to see from the Trump administration. We can debate whether or not that was wise, but it just was. You know, people who are casual followers of politics, they're like, this guy's just gonna, he doesn't care. He doesn't give a damn. He's gonna release the information. That'll be a permanently severed relationship. I think that the trust is really broken for Trump with that group. And it's not an insignificant group of people either.
And that they had 1,000 FBI agents working around the clock, crossing out his name. That doesn't inspire confidence.
No way. Sure doesn't.
That was Emily Jashinsky, DC correspondent for Unheard. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of a track from a mix by the Berlin-based DJ Beck, Rebecca Godfrey, from her June New York Art Core showcase. Till next week, bye.
Not friends, not enemies, just strangers with some memories. Coming a long time, talked about it over wine.